world and everything in it is brought to you by listeners like us. Hi, my name is Ryan Gobb, and I live and work as a hard rock miner in the highland interior jungle of Papua, Indonesia. I'd like to say hi and see you soon to my beautiful wife, Thea, who's back home in Colorado homeschooling our four children. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. The massive infrastructure bill, what's in it and what will it mean for Americans? We'll talk about it.
We will talk about it today on Washington Wednesday. Also, World Tour, plus bringing the gospel to Olympians.
We can't control what is happening under the scenes. All we can control is being faithful and doing what God has called us to do and living out our lives and sharing the good news of the gospel.
And the joys of Jigsaw.
It's Wednesday, August 4th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Time now for the news. Here's Kent Covington.
The Biden administration announced a new 60-day eviction ban on Tuesday that will apply to most of the country until early October. The U.S. Supreme Court allowed the CDC's prior eviction ban to remain in place until it expired on July 31st, but the court indicated that it would not uphold another extension. The CDC, however, said it identified a legal authority for a different moratorium. Hours earlier, President Biden told reporters at the White House,
"And my hope is it's going to be a new moratorium that in some way covers close to 90% of the American people who are renters."
The CDC allowed the prior eviction ban to expire at the end of July. Citing the Supreme Court's ruling, the Biden administration said it did not have the legal authority to extend it further. The administration said states and cities must be more aggressive in releasing nearly $47 billion in relief for renters on the verge of eviction. But Democratic lawmakers kept pressure on the White House to extend the moratorium in spite of the high court ruling. Also at the White House Tuesday, the president touted an uptick in new vaccinations.
Over the past 2 weeks, the eight states with the highest current case rates have seen a doubling of the number of people newly vaccinated each day.
The United States this week finally reached Biden's goal of getting at least one COVID-19 shot into the arms of 70% of adults, though a month later than the president had hoped. Cases continue to rise nationally. Most new infections and the overwhelming majority of serious cases are among unvaccinated Americans. With that in mind, Biden made another appeal to those who have not yet received a shot. And in an effort to persuade the unvaccinated, the president said he's urging states to offer $100 cash incentives. Several states have done so, and Biden said daily vaccinations are up 25% in those states. He also called on businesses to incentivize vaccinations for employees. Meantime, more states and cities are introducing new mandates to try and halt the spread of the Delta variant. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio on Tuesday announced unprecedented regulations.
The key to NYC pass will be a first-in-the-nation approach. It will require vaccination for workers and customers in indoor dining, in indoor fitness facilities, indoor entertainment facilities.
That means customers at those New York City businesses will have to show proof of vaccination. The city plans to start enforcing the program on September 13th. And the state of Louisiana has ordered nearly everyone, vaccinated or not, to wear masks once again in all indoor public settings. The Delta variant is hitting the South especially hard. Florida on Sunday broke a previous record for current hospitalizations due to COVID-19. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is pushing back against the findings of a state investigation into sexual harassment claims against him. The state's Democratic Attorney General Letitia James announced those findings on Tuesday.
The independent investigation found that Governor Cuomo sexually harassed multiple women, many of whom were young women, by engaging in unwanted groping, kisses, hugging, and by making inappropriate comments.
The nearly five-month investigation led by two outside lawyers concluded that 11 women who made accusations against him were telling the truth. But Cuomo again said the accusations are not accurate.
I never touched anyone inappropriately or made inappropriate sexual advances.
The probe also determined that Cuomo worked to retaliate against one of his accusers. Following that report, many fellow Democrats, including President Biden, called on the governor to resign immediately, but Cuomo again said he is not going anywhere. The Taliban pressed ahead with their advances in southern Afghanistan on Tuesday. It has now captured 9 out of 10 districts of the capital city in Helmand province. Afghan government forces launched airstrikes backed by the U.S. military in a desperate effort to defend the city. The fall of Lashkar-Gah would be a major turning point in the offensive that the Taliban has waged in recent months as U.S. and NATO forces withdraw. It would also be the first provincial capital the Taliban has captured in years. Upon hearing that news, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell had sharp words for the White House on Tuesday.
The president's rush pullback from Afghanistan has left our friends and partners in the lurch and rolled out a red carpet for a Taliban takeover that is already underway.
The Afghan military dispatched elite commando units to help protect key government buildings, including the local police and army headquarters, but some fear it is only a matter of time before Taliban forces overrun those facilities. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, what's inside the Senate's $1 trillion infrastructure bill, plus puzzling and providence? This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Wednesday, the 4th day of August, 2021. So glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eichert. It's time now for Washington Wednesday. Today, the infrastructure of the infrastructure bill. A group of senators from both parties on Sunday finished writing the first draft of a roughly $1 trillion program. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, as it's called, runs about 2,700 pages thick. It calls for $550 billion in new spending over 5 years, over and above already planned spending. It would fund work on a wide range of public works projects. While a bipartisan group of negotiators was able to come together, it does remain to be seen whether the final bill can muster enough GOP votes to avoid other Republicans blocking it with a filibuster.
So what exactly is in this bill? How would it be paid for? And what will it all mean for American taxpayers? Joining us now to help answer those questions is Chris Edwards. He's an economist and director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute. Chris, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me today.
Well, first of all, give us a high-level snapshot of what is in this bill and where all that money would go.
Well, Congress was scheduled to reauthorize its regular highway programs this year anyway, and that would have cost about $500 billion or so anyway. This new bill that Congress is now considering would essentially double that amount of money up to $1 trillion, as you mentioned. So this bill would spend a lot of money on things the federal government already spends money on, like highways and transit. But it would add in a bunch of new subsidies for things like electric utilities, broadband, and electric vehicle charging stations.
Okay, well, one concern raised by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle is potential corporate welfare within this bill. Chris, from what you've read, what is fueling those concerns?
I'm really concerned about this aspect of the bill, that it goes into new areas of federal subsidization for privately owned infrastructure. So it would provide $73 billion to electric utilities to expand their transmission grid. It would provide $7 billion for electric vehicle charging stations. It would provide $65 billion for broadband in rural areas. I think that's a dangerous area for the federal government to get involved in, because then, you know, other industries that provide private sector infrastructure are now going to start lobbying Washington for their own subsidies. Electric vehicle charging stations, Some of your listeners may not know, but there's already about 30,000 electric vehicle charging stations installed across the country by the private sector. If you go to your local Target or Walmart, they're already putting in these charging stations. So from my perspective, I'd say, hey, let's let the private sector do this. Electric vehicles are increasingly popular. And the private industry already has a lot of incentive to put in these stations themselves. So I don't think we need the additional federal subsidies here.
Not to mention that most people that I know couldn't afford an electric car right now anyway. So why would we have federal spending to fund what rich people can buy?
There is a lot of that sort of subsidize the rich stuff going on with federal infrastructure spending. Another good example is transit spending. You know, most federal transit subsidies actually go to light rail systems and Amtrak. And if you look actually the demographics of who uses those projects, it tends to be the elite, upper middle income, higher income people. And indeed, some of the federal subsidies for cities that encourage them to build light rail systems, they actually take money away from their bus systems, which are the systems that are the most help to lower income workers who need to get to their jobs. So, you know, I'm concerned about that bias towards rail with these federal subsidies as well.
Well, I know that two sides disagreed throughout this process on how to pay for the infrastructure spending. How did they resolve those differences so far, and how would this bill pay for it?
Well, Congress likes to spend, of course, and neither party likes to raise the taxes to pay for it, and that's why we have such massive federal deficits already. Unfortunately, this bill is kind of unpaid for, and it will push the costs onto taxpayers down the road. There's some accounting sleight of hand here. I mean, for example, the supporters of the bill say that there's $200 billion of money that has already been authorized for previous pandemic spending that is now going to be repurposed for this infrastructure bill. But really, I'd like to see that money pay down the debt. If we have extra money that wasn't spent on unemployment insurance benefits, for example, I'd rather use that money to pay down debt rather than this new spending. I mean, ultimately, federal government spending is going to land on taxpayers. If we're going to increase debt now, and that means taxpayers in the future will have to pay those higher charges then.
So just to be clear, as it stands now, this bill would merely add to the national debt. It doesn't do anything to ameliorate that.
That's right. There are some sort of revenue raisers, but they're pretty minor. Mainly, we're going to be adding more borrowing. The federal deficit's already $3 trillion this year, an enormous amount of money. So we would be adding to that with this bill.
GOP Senator Rob Portman said the bill would help the United States better compete with China and would make the economy more productive. Chris, doesn't this bill help to do some of those things, at least somewhat?
I don't think so. And here's why I say that, because state governments own most of the government infrastructure in America. So, for example, the entire interstate highway system, may surprise some of your listeners, is actually owned by state governments. And transit systems are owned by local governments. So if those state and local governments think that they could increase the efficiency of their state economy with more investment, they would be doing it already. And state governments already have their own gas taxes that fund their own highway systems. They've got income and sales taxes. They already spend a lot on their own infrastructure. And if they want to spend more, they are free to do so. I don't see any advantage in Washington coming in and increasing spending for every state. Every state has different needs, you know. To give you an example, I mean, the southern states, Florida and Texas, are growing rapidly. They have higher demands for new highway infrastructure. Well, great. They can raise their own taxes to fund their own highway expansion. Some of the slower growing states in the Northeast, they don't need new highway capacity. So we shouldn't be, you know, spending so much money there. So I think that's the problem when Washington comes in. It's sort of a one size fits all. And I think the states are really, you know, they're capable of funding their own infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Anything else in this bill that really caught your attention?
Well, one interesting part of the infrastructure bill is that the Biden administration is very interested in taking steps to avert climate change, and you know, which is a sensible goal. But the interesting thing about this infrastructure bill is it is not funded in a green manner. And what I mean here is this: is that the green way to fund infrastructure is by user charges. So if you want people to use highways less, you should increase the gas taxes so that they drive less. If you want people to conserve water, you ought to increase user charges for water in order to do new water investment. But this bill, the infrastructure bill, does the opposite. So, for example, it would subsidize electric vehicle charging stations. Well, that's sort of subsidizing people to use energy. It seems to me that you'd want to fund electric vehicle charging stations by user charges on the on drivers. So I think there's a missed opportunity here that we could have moved America's infrastructure more toward green financing by increasing user charges to fund new infrastructure spending, not by subsidizing it with federal deficits and future taxes.
Chris Edwards with the Cato Institute has been our guest. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Additional support comes from Ligonier Ministries, celebrating 50 years of trustworthy Bible teaching. Thousands of discipleship resources anchored in the historic Christian faith are available at ligonier.org. From Dort University, offering reimbursed campus visits so you can learn firsthand about Dort's Christ-centered education. Details at dort.edu/visit. And from Heart of Dakota, providing Christ-centered, literature-based homeschool curriculum from preschool through high school. More at heartofdakota.com.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, our reporter in Africa with World Tour. Here's Onize Ohikere.
We start today in southern Europe. Boats manned by volunteers helped evacuate people trapped by wildfires on Monday along Turkey's coast. Fires that started last week have destroyed huge swaths of forests and threatened seaside towns popular with tourists. Planes carrying fire suppressant flew over the hilly terrain. Parts of Greece, Italy, and Spain are also struggling to contain deadly blazes. The region is struggling under an unusual heat wave that has seen temperatures soar over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Next, to the Middle East. Western nations are blaming Iran for an attack on a tanker off the coast of Oman last week. The ship is owned by an Israeli company. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Iran would face consequences for the attack.
And as I noted, we are in very close contact and coordination with the United Kingdom, Israel, Romania, and other countries. There will be a collective response.
A British security guard and a Romanian crew member died in the drone attack. Tehran has denied involvement, calling the accusations against it baseless. But analysts say the attack bore all the hallmarks of similar tit-for-tat exchanges between Israel and Iran. Attacks in the region in recent months have targeted vessels linked to both countries. Next, to Southeast Asia. Myanmar's military ruler declared an extension to the country's state of emergency on Sunday. Elections may not be held for another 2 years. That could extend the military's rule for 18 months longer than generals initially promised when they removed the civilian government in February. Mass protests against the junta have died down, but analysts say opposition remains strong. Mani Mong is a researcher with Human Rights Watch.
We know that there's still resistance happening, and we certainly know that there's guerrilla activity happening around the cities. I mean, every day there are protests, and you know, quite often we're hearing about these small bombs going off around the cities as well. So it doesn't mean that people have given up, but certainly I don't think we're seeing the same loud campaigning that was happening at the very beginning. And of course, people are tired. This has been going on for almost 6 months now. People don't have the economy or the budget or the money to keep going. And now many of them are sick.
Nearly 1,000 people have died in clashes with police in the last 6 months.
do hereby swear by Almighty God.
And finally, we end today here in Africa. South Sudan swore in a new national parliament on Monday. The lawmakers are a mix of ruling party members and former rebel factions. The retired Honorable Gemma Nunu Kumba is Speaker of the Transitional Legislative Assembly.
I'm sure you are aware that the challenges ahead of us are enormous. To confront and overcome those challenges, the situation demands that we, as the representative of our people, should look beyond political, partisan, and tribal expediencies and focus keenly on the common good of all.
The creation of an inclusive National Assembly was a key condition of the 2018 ceasefire. It ended 5 years of bloodshed between government and rebel forces that left nearly 400,000 people dead. The truce has largely held since then, but ongoing political disputes could drag the country back to the brink of civil war. That's this week's World Tour. Reporting for World, I'm Onize Ohikere in Abuja, Nigeria.
Well, you know, some people are just collectors. Stamp collectors, coin collectors. I think you get the idea. But one man in Berlin may have taken the idea a bit too far. He is a military arsenal collector. He's got a 45-ton tank, an anti-aircraft cannon, World War II-era machine guns, and other military equipment. Now, none of this was a big secret in his town. During a particularly harsh winter, for example, the man even brought out the tank to plow snow. I bet it worked great.
I bet it did.
But this is a no-no in Germany. Or maybe a 99. So a court ordered him to sell or donate the items to a museum within the next 2 years. So between now and then,
I know nothing. Nothing.
It's the world and everything in it. Today is Wednesday, August 4th. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, Olympic Ministry. The Olympic Games come to a close on Sunday in Tokyo. The entire event looked and sounded much different than usual, with almost no spectators in the stands.
But a small band of faithful Christians already in Tokyo took the gospel to the streets. Last week, world correspondent Bonnie Pritchett spoke with U.S. missionaries and a Japanese pastor in Tokyo to get their story.
Free English conversation. Fun, free, fast English conversation.
On a shady sidewalk in Tokyo, Japan, two American women hold signs advertising free 5-minute English lessons and uniquely designed Olympic trading pins. The women are missionaries to Japan and taking part in a citywide evangelistic outreach during the 2020 Olympic Games.
God, we pray for today that you will lead our efforts, that you will specifically lead people to us that are searching for you.
Yes. So this weekend, Christians in Tokyo will cross the finish line of an Olympic-themed ministry. It's not the marathon they had planned for almost 2 years ago. It's more like the steeplechase, with extra hurdles tossed into their path. Ever-evolving COVID-19 protocols have kept the ministry team of local and foreign Christians constantly adjusting their game plan. They're doing it without losing sight of the goal, sharing the gospel with Tokyo's 37 million residents.
It's huge, and you have in Japan 99.5% lostness. You have churches with the average attendance of maybe 30 to 40 people.
That's Scott Bradford. He and his wife, Julie, are missionaries in Tokyo with the Southern Baptist Convention's International Mission Board. They came to the world's most populous city in late 2019. Tokyo ministry teams had just completed an evangelistic outreach during the Rugby World Cup. They anticipated duplicating those efforts for the Olympic Games only a few months later.
Yeah, we have a plan to make a lot of evangelistic activity.
Akira Watanabe is a pastor at Tokyo Baptist Church, a partner in the World Cup and Olympic outreaches.
And that was very successful. So we had a big expectation of Olympic, but unfortunately, since last year, the situation is totally changed.
Julie Bradford said postponing the games affected more than the Japanese ministry teams. Over 200 international volunteers from outside Japan were prepared to assist the effort.
I think there was a lot of disappointment. We did have to regroup. We did have to look at things and say, okay, God's got this, but you know, we have to join him, and but we do have to grieve, right?
So there's that. The Bradford said God redeemed that time. With the games on hold, the newly transplanted Bradfords turned their attention to forging relationships with their mission partners and Tokyo's handful of Christian churches. They believe their team was better prepared when the 2020 Olympic Games finally opened July 23rd.
Hello from Tokyo, Japan. Hey, we're right here at Nakano Station, as you can see right here behind us. Today, we were doing five-minute English, and we were able to engage 80 people today.
Just like Olympic officials, the ministry team has constantly adjusted to new Japanese government mandates. Churches scheduled to host ministry events are closed. Gatherings, even outdoors, are strictly limited. Street evangelism plans need fine-tuning again.
How do we do these activities and spread it out and still be strategic and effective, but also do it in a way that is not going to raise attention and is not going to cause people to be uncomfortable.
The recent government protocols put Japanese Christians in an awkward position.
This month is not good for evangelism.
How could they assist without appearing to defy their own government?
Yeah, as Roman 13 once said, let everyone be subject to the governing authority.
So, Japanese Christians are taking a support role. They're praying. And they're offering their churches for follow-up activities once it's allowed. Despite the scaled-back volunteer corps, the mission team presses on. They're covering the city in prayer, walking through neighborhoods, and riding trains. Street evangelism includes five-minute English lessons, small sports-themed outdoor events, and the obligatory Olympic pin trading. Scott Bradford tapped into the extremely popular cosplay culture and donned an anime character costume to hand out Bible literature near the city's busiest pedestrian crosswalk. As of July 31st, the team had spoken with over 500 people. 62 of the conversations included gospel presentations. The Olympic Evangelism Project may not be reaching the world as originally planned, but for one man, among the 37 million people, their faithfulness may have made all the difference in the world. U.S. missionary Pierce Height explains.
Yeah, one of those cool engagements we had was actually a guy from China who's here as a student. And he has had a really hard time meeting people and making friends. And so he just straight up asked us directly, would you be my friend? And so we talked to him and said, we would love to be your friend. We'd love to get to know.
The student was invited to and agreed to attend a follow-up event. Those sharing the gospel in Tokyo the last 2 weeks have little control over when, where, or even how it takes place. But there is one thing they do control.
And so we can't control what is happening under the scenes. All we can control is being faithful and doing what God has called us to do and living out our lives and sharing the good news of the gospel.
Reporting for World, I'm Bonnie Pritchett. I'd like to thank Scott Bradford and Andrew Rivers for providing audio from their work in Tokyo for this report. Arigato gozaimasu. Today is Wednesday, August 4th. You're listening to The World and Everything in It, and we're so glad you are. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Here's world commentator Steve West on the philosophy of jigsaw puzzles.
My favorite puzzles are the kind other people work, because that's what it is to me, work.
When I look at a tabletop of 1,000 ragged, zigzaggedy colored cardboard cutouts, I'm just lost. My wife, on the other hand, is enchanted by the thought of a new puzzle to pore over. She sets up a table by the window and opens up shop. Leave her alone for a minute, take your eye off of her, and there she is bent over the table, puzzling her way to a completed picture. A print of blooming flowers, cityscape, or animals. All the little gaps of her day are filled with puzzling. It's a silent activity. There's no humming satisfaction that attends it. No singing, no sighing of frustration, no exclamations of glee at finding the missing piece. Just a quiet joy, a dogged determination, a resilient spirit, a patient trying, and then succeeding. God mending the fabric of creation, disorder to order, chaos to creation. I ask her what she likes about puzzles, about the pointless waste of time and unending frustration. Well, I keep that last bit to myself. She says, I like the satisfaction of finding the right piece, of working with my hands. She doesn't even look up as she says this. The task lays before her. Although there are a thousand other things I would rather do, I appreciate part of why she loves it so much. The disassembled puzzle on the table is a problem a little God can fix. The big ones require a bigger God, the God. Despite the fact that utopian schemes abound, humankind is not evolving to perfect peace and happiness and bliss. We can't fix the people around us, remedy human imperfection. We can't even fix ourselves. That requires a better puzzler. The other day I watched her begin again. She spread all the pieces out on the table. She brooded over the deep, over the chaos, until a flicker of light came. She pulled back her hair so she could concentrate, putting on her placid but serious puzzling face. Her hands moved over the pieces, trying one and then another, until she heard the barely audible click of a fit, and the world sighed just a bit. A strand of hair broke free and traced her face, but she ignored it in her deliberation. Starting with the periphery, she built a frame for this new world, finding the edges and corners. And over time, it began to take shape. I sensed hope and promise, a time when all things fit. And then, a few days later, she finished. Leaning back, she rested from her work. I could almost hear her say, "It's good. It's very good." I admired her work, my hand resting on her shoulder, and smiled at her pleasure. Well, it's a start on the puzzle of the world. I'm Steve West.
Tomorrow, political diversity. Democrats in South Texas are rethinking their party allegiance. We'll tell you what that might mean for next year's midterm elections. And trick shots. We'll introduce you to a YouTube sensation whose claim to fame is doing what seems to be doing the impossible. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Jesus said, "Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye?" Go now in grace and peace.